So it's somewhat odd topic tonight. I'm going to be talking about the work of anti-racism through the lens of Buddhism. And I think I'll start by saying that, of course, part of Buddhism is compassion, compassion for all beings. And it's a funny thing because, of course, you know, I can walk around thinking that I'm being compassionate, but of course, if I'm walking around and people think I'm a jerk, if I'm hurting people and offending people, that doesn't really count as compassion. It doesn't count as compassion if it's just a trip in my head and it's not landing well for people. It's only compassion when there's this reciprocity, when there's this actual landing and people feel seen and heard and acknowledged. And so just that by itself really casts a lot of the anti-racism work in a very important light. Of course, I assume that you're familiar with this idea of white privilege. As a white man, I have this privilege as I walk through life. There's all kinds of possibilities that are open to me that are not necessarily open to people of color. And white privilege is it's part and parcel of racism. And so it's part and parcel of a system of hatred. And so without even realizing it, you know, in other words, if I hadn't done this work, without even realizing it, I would be walking through the world carrying a kind of hatred that would be impacting people, and I wouldn't even be aware that I was doing that, you know? And so there's so many sides to white privilege. And part of white privilege is just it's talked about as the right to be comfortable. You know, as a white person, I have the right to be comfortable, that sort of thing. And, you know, if someone starts bringing this up, then I can, you know, get all uncomfortable and agitated with it and essentially, you know, ask them to take care of me for even bringing it up. And of course, the threat in that is that if someone else, you know, agitates me and then I report to law enforcement, you know, they're threatening me somehow, you know, that could actually wind up with horrible consequences for somebody, you know? And so it's a very tricky thing. I've talked to many people of color who talk about having to feel like they need to moderate themselves or make themselves safe around white people, you know? And it's very funny when you think of it on the surface, you know, the right to be comfortable. Like, if we said this to the Buddha would laugh at us. There's no right to be comfortable. It directly flies in the face of the first noble truth of Buddhism. You know, life is uncomfortable. It's supposed to be uncomfortable, you know? That's the nature of it, you know? Another part of privilege is just being able to get what you want, you know. And even apart from any consideration of race, it's a fascinating spiritual question. What happens when you don't get what you want? What happens when things don't go your way? You know, how do you behave? What stories do you have? What emotional reactions do you have when you don't get what you want? Again, somewhat stereotypically around race, white people tend to get very bent out of shape. You know, I didn't get what I want. I deserve what I want. You know, this sort of thing. Whereas sometimes people of color stereotypically go more into resignation. Well, here it goes again, you know, that kind of thing. And neither one of those is really just feeling into the vulnerability of the moment. feeling into, you know, what, it, you know, the sort of the feeling, the emotions, and the deep letting go in the moment. Another dimension is anger. Anger and fear. You know. And first of all, there's the one problem of the fear that white people have, especially of black people. You know, the stereotypical, nothing white people fear more than the anger of black people, you know. And the tremendous harm that white people have inflicted by seeing black people as objects of fear. You know. There, I see this man in my neighborhood. I think he's up to no good. And then, you know, something horrible happens to that man, even though he may be totally innocent. Fear is very interesting. The Dalai Lama calls fear a destructive emotion. At one point, he was talking with Western neurobiologists, and he used this term, destructive emotion. And the Western neurobiologists were thinking, well, you know, what does that mean? Does it mean, you know, like you get so mad that you smash something? Like, what's a destructive emotion? And the Dalai Lama's definition was very interesting. A destructive emotion is any emotion that distorts our point of view. Any emotion that distorts our point of view is a destructive emotion. And so fear is certainly a destructive emotion. You know, and it's often the case, you know, when we're projecting fear out and there's not a particularly clear threat, you know, when it's ambiguous, but we're projecting a large amount of fear out, often that's because there's something inside that we're not facing. There's actually an internal fear that we need to face. And of course, those are always the hardest to face because once we acknowledge it, we can't run away from it because it's our stuff, you know. That's why people tend to like to find the fears outside, because then at least you can, you know, shut and bolt the door and pretend that it's not going to get you, that sort of thing. And on the other side, there's the role of fear, I'd say legitimate fear, for example, in the case of Mr. Rayshard Brooks. Mr. Rayshard Brooks was, he was the man who was killed in a Wendy's parking lot. He had fallen asleep in his car. Other cars were having to go around. You know, they called the cops, and at first it was a very peaceful, you know, they were examining him and going to charge him with DUI. And then suddenly, without announcing, they started to make the move to put handcuffs on him. And then suddenly he panicked and fought back and got a taser away from somebody and then wound up being shot. And I think that case and cases like that lend themselves to a kind of misinterpretation. And what I mean by that is, for example, suppose I were arrested, you know, I mean, I hope that doesn't happen, but suppose I were arrested for something, and whether real or imagined, you know, I might be dismayed, I might be annoyed, but it would never cross my mind that my life might be in danger. You know, it would never cross my mind, especially if I were innocent and the cops were mistaking me for someone else and arresting me. That would be a nuisance, but it wouldn't occur to me that my life would be a danger. And yet that's so present for African Americans. that fear that any particular day I could be totally innocent, but any particular day the cops could single me out and that could be it. You know, and what we're seeing often in these confrontations between the police and African-Americans, that African-Americans are in full flight or fight or flight mode. And of course, once you go into fight or flight mode, rationality is out, balance is out, like you're trying to survive at all costs, you know? And so I think, you know, one important part of facing white privilege is just to feel into that, feel into what must it feel like to live day after day with that terror? You know, what, how would that feel on top of, you know, on top of all our other human struggles and human difficulties and God knows financial and romance and all the other things that we struggle with, to have that raw terror just being part of every day. And it raises another interesting question, and again, you know, apart from the conversation about race, just how do we relate to people who are triggered? How do we relate to people who have gone into fight or flight? And it's very tricky because, you know, in psychology, they talk about maximizers and minimizers. So maximizers, when they get triggered, there's an explosion of energy, yelling or tears or, you know, it becomes obvious to everyone in the room that they've been triggered. Minimizers are the people, when they get triggered, everything shuts down, everything locks down, so they get very, very quiet, you know. And so if you're not perceptive, it's easy to even miss that a minimizer has been triggered, you know. And how do we relate, you know, if we're trying to live with compassion, how do we relate to someone who is triggered? You know, and it takes a tremendous amount of caring, just a tremendous amount of listening, giving that person all the room they need to, you know, not necessarily, you know, going into your head and rationally saying, well, there's nothing to worry about, because then you're creating this dissonance between, you know, the words that are coming to them and their felt experience in their body, you know. And of course, different people have different cycles when they're triggered. Some people are triggered and you know, if given space to go through it and calming influences, 10 or 15 minutes later, they can be done with it. Some people stay triggered for hours or days, you know. You know, and so it's I think it's always an important consideration to think about, you know, what kind of caring can we give to people who are triggered? What kind of caring can we give to people who are in full flight or fight or flight mode? Another level of thinking about anti-racism and multiculturalism is thinking about the layers of culture. And people like to talk about, you know, shallow culture, medium, and then deep culture, you know. And shallow culture would be more like, you know, say in a classroom, you know, on Black History Month, like, you know, putting up pictures of famous African Americans on the wall during Black History Month, you know. And it's, you know, it's a lovely gesture, but it's more like a head-based thing. One aspect of deep culture has to do with the relation with the emotions. How emotional we are, how embodied we are. At least stereotypically, a lot of WASPy white culture has been about repressing emotions, about living in the head, about not being emotional, about not being particularly physical. Whereas stereotypically, a lot of Black and Latino culture has been about being very emotional, very embodied, lots of dance, lots of, displays of emotion in those cultures. And it's fascinating because there's been this long history. This is one that goes way, way back in white culture. There's been this long history going back to the ancient Greeks of saying essentially, mind is something pure and good, and emotions are bad. And so we got a lot of that, that was around in the ancient Greeks even before the church came along, and then the church picked it up. A lot of that has been used over the centuries to oppress women, men are creatures of mind, women are creatures of the emotion, so they're lower, like that whole thing. And then, of course, as with the development of racism in America and the dynamics there, it was also used to justify why Blacks and Latinos were lower, because they were people of emotion. They had uncontrolled emotions, unlike the good white people who could control their emotions, this sort of thing. And of course, typically East Asians also tend to be, again, very stereotypically, tend to be not so emotionally expressive, more having to do with, the dysfunctional, ways that Confucianism has played out. But I believe this is one of the reasons that whites have essentially assigned Asians as the quote unquote model minority. Like they are better than the other kinds of people of color, because they're more like white people in that way, all these really sick ways that white people have pitted races against each other. So again, apart from questions of race, I would just say, contrary to Plato and those people, that it's very important to be embodied. It's very important to be in touch with our emotions, that the core of who we are is who we are emotionally. And the head, the head is great for individual problem solving, strategy, that sort of thing. The head is useless for anything that really matters. Friendship, love, connection, meaning, purpose in life, all these sorts of things. And the body just has such tremendous wisdom. It's America is a place that has a tremendous fear of vulnerability. So it has a tremendous fear of being in touch with the body, because the body, when we're in touch with the body, we're in touch with all the rawness of life, and that's scary. When you're feeling everything in a raw way, sometimes it hurts, but it always feels alive and vital, unlike being in your head where nothing is vital. It's funny, we don't get a choice in this world. We don't get to feel the good stuff and then not feel the bad stuff. Again, this goes back to the first noble truth. This should not be a surprise to anyone. So at this point, I will share the quote sheet. I'll put it in the chat. So an Amish proverb, instead of putting others in their place, put yourself in their place. Just very simple. I love the Amish. Mother Teresa said, if we have no peace, it is because we have forgotten that we belong to each other. and relatedly from the Christian mystic Thomas Merton, the whole idea of compassion is based on a keen awareness of the interdependence of all these living beings, which are all part of one another and are all involved in one another. From the great Jungian, Marie-Louise von Franz, who was a colleague of Carl Jung for many years. The healing hero, therefore, is one who finds some creative way out, a way not already known, and does not follow a pattern. Ordinary sick people follow ordinary patterns, but the shaman cannot be cured by using the normal, usual methods of healing. He has to find his unique way, the only way that applies to him. The creative personality who can do that then becomes a healer and is recognized as such by his colleagues. And so really this deep idea that each one of us has to find our own deep healing. And it's exactly by following that deep healing that we have so much to offer to others. Nelson Mandela said, quite simply, our human compassion binds us, the one to the other, not in pity or patronizingly, but as human beings who have learned how to turn our common suffering into hope for the future. And relatedly, Desmond Tutu, who is still with us, God's dream is that you and I and all of us realize that we are family, that we are made for togetherness, for goodness, and for compassion. The Dalai Lama on compassion, very simple. If you want others to be happy, practice compassion. If you want to be happy, practice compassion. Joan Halifax says, compassion has enemies, and those enemies are things like pity, moral outrage, and fear. That one is deep. And fear is definitely very much an opposite of love. I mean, both the Christian tradition and the Buddhist tradition are very clear on that. The radical theologian Carol P. Christ says, man, it was said, had two natures, a rational nature and an animal or bodily nature. These two natures, as were thought, were continually at war with one another. Whereas reason should have been able to rule the body, all too often it seemed the body asserted its own needs and desires. The practice of asceticism in the East as well as in the West rose out of attempts to control the unruly body through denial and sometimes punishment. While women also practice asceticism, the literature of asceticism, written primarily by men, is filled with images equating the temptations of the body with women and the female body. Instead of accepting the changing body as part of the self, asceticism has attempted to deny it. Great cruelty to the self and the body have all too often been the fruits of this view. So again, this worldview I was talking about earlier, she describes it very, very well. Daniel Goldman says, true compassion means not only feeling another's pain, but also being moved to help relieve it. We have a couple from Sharon Salzberg who says, we need compassion and courage to change the conditions that support our suffering. These conditions are things like ignorance, bitterness, negligence, clinging, and holding on. She also said, when we contemplate the miracle of embodied life, we begin to partner with our bodies in a kinder way. Steve Goodyear says, get yourself grounded and you can navigate even the stormiest roads in peace. And I would add not only that, but if I'm grounded, I can also support other people when they're on their stormy roads. Often when people are triggered, what they most need is someone who is deeply grounded. Professor Kendi, in his wonderful book, How to Be Anti-Racist, he just says quite simply, in the end, hating white people becomes hating black people. In the end, hating black people becomes hating white people, that there's this deep interconnection. Rupi Kaur says, it was when I stopped searching for home within others and lifted the foundations of home within myself, I found that there were no roots more intimate than those between a mind and a body that have decided to be whole. Kristen Bowman says, our bodies play a huge role in the accomplishment of our goals and our overall happiness. Embodiment is about tuning into our physical bodies and learning ways to support our health and well-being so that we can do what we need to do and enjoy the journey. Cheryl Pallant simply says, let your body come call you back to yourself, in your most deeply embodied self. Land, dive, soar. Find the crumbs that lead back home. Moadesa Najumi says, you are not always right. It's not always about being right. The best thing you can offer others is understanding. Being an active listener is about more than just listening. It is often about reciprocating and being receptive to someone else. Everyone has woes. No one is safe from pain. However, we all suffer in different ways. So learn to adapt to each person, know your audience, and reserve yourself for the people who have earned the depths of you. That last part is important. Hong Curley says, quite simply, a true healer, someone who heals himself first so others can benefit from his healing. Devin McDermott says, trauma stays with us for a long time, often our whole lives. But here's the tricky part. Trauma lives in the nonverbal parts of the brain. That means traumatized people often don't have the words to remember or explain their trauma. Trauma reactions can sneak up on someone without warning, and they might have a really hard time explaining what's happening to them. Elizabeth Eiler says, in the vessel of your body, you yourself are the world tree, deep roots in the earth and a crown of stars. Your essence bridges dimensions. And finally, Alethea Luna says, now more than ever, our society is in need of sensitive and empathic people. Now more than ever, the human race needs to go inward and connect with the soul again. As natural-born healers, intuitives, and mentors, it is not only our responsibility, but also our destiny to help humanity heal.